Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're looking at Book 12, Chapter 7. General was the only question that I asked you guys. General. I've got nothing. Sorry, I do apologize. The previous chapter just inspired nothing. No questions, no anything, nothing, just nothing, just gave me nothing. The one thing that I did think was astonishing was after chapter 6, giving so much flack to the prosecutor about his speech for going for so long and for being so pointless, then to go into chapter 7 and realize that chapter 7 was a whole nother chapter of speech, of the same speech. I was just blown away. Now, I had to have a little look forward. Today's chapter is yet another continuation of the prosecutor's speech, 8 more pages, which is a good like 25 minutes of, or 20 minutes of reading, something around there. And tomorrow's chapter is entitled Chapter 9, The End of the Prosecutor's Speech, which goes for another 8 or so pages. It's a, no exaggeration, it's about a 1 hour and 10 minute long rant, which we're supposed to suspend our disbelief long enough, like sufficiently to believe that at the end of a trial, he stood before a crowd of an audience and spoke for 1 hour and 10 minutes. Which, I don't know. I just don't know what to say about this book. I don't get it. It's just not, it's not a character talking. It's just the author talking through the voice of a character. And then he'll play a different character and, like, be his own devil's advocate and be like, oh, yeah, but you think that, but what about the other thing that's the opposite? And then he'll talk about that for 1 hour and 10 minutes. And it's just him having a pointless conversation with himself that isn't interesting. Oh, my God. Sorry. It's 3 in the morning. I'm doing this later and later. Anyway, yeah, no, this book's driving me nuts. And this 32-page long speech, 32-page long speech, is unacceptably self-indulgent writing by the author, by Dosto. Anyway, hey, tonight we had a really cool event. So last year I made a book with a school called Hampton Park Secondary School. Probably told you guys about this. They've got a lot of refugees at their school. A lot of students are refugees. And quite a few teachers there are refugees. And so they made a book of true refugee stories last year. And tonight, as part of Refugee Week, today is actually Refugee Day, International Refugee Day, whatever that means, or Australian National, I'm not sure if it's a national, I don't know what it was. Anyway, it was as part of the celebrations for Refugee Day, they had a public event to celebrate the launch of the book that they made last year. And it was also an official event of the Melbourne Emerging Writers Festival, which is a pretty big festival in Melbourne. There's really two big writing festivals. One is called the Writers Festival, and the other's called the Emerging Writers Festival. So to be part of the official program for that was really cool. And so we had this big event in Bunjil Place, which is a $125 million library and theatre and function centre and council hall. And they put us up there and gave us a really good venue to host this launch. And yeah, it was really, really cool. It was really cool. There was local, the mayor was there, and the member there was politicians there, let's just say that. There was some politicians and some people representing local community organisations and other schools and parents and authors and stuff. So it was really cool. And representatives from the Emerging Writers Festival. So I just did a whole lot of schmoozing and I don't know, meeting people. It was just great. It was a really cool night. That book was made through my small business, which goes to schools and helps them make their own book. So, I don't know, just to play my small part in the creation of that book that clearly meant a lot to a lot of people. It was a really cool night. Not to mention the, I'm really proud of those authors, but also, you know, it's cool to get some kind of recognition from the community, you know, make me feel proud of myself because, yeah, I don't know, it's just nice. You know, we put a lot of effort into making this book and there it is. We're getting a pat on the back, so that feels good. Anyway, it's 3 a.m. now. So I did have a really good night and I was really buzzing, but then I got home and ate a bunch of junk food and played video games for 2 hours just to unwind because my mind was kind of buzzing. It was really exciting. And here we are. So if I had have recorded this a few hours ago, I would have been absolutely like electric. I would have been really excited, but now I'm just kind of food coma and tired. Oh gosh, okay. I Am Norwegian said, I haven't watched Star Trek TNG, only the new Netflix one. Oh, that's quoting me. Yeah, I said that. I Am Norwegian said, oh no, give TNG a go. People say that it really hits its stride in the third season, but I thought the quality of episodes was pretty constant throughout. Yeah, actually, that's exactly why I haven't watched it, because so many people say, like, it takes until the third season to get good. And it's like, wow, that's a long way to watch a show before it clicks. You know what I mean? Like, my attention span is just shocking recently. If a show doesn't grab me in, like, the first half of the first episode, then I just don't keep watching it. You know? People keep telling me to watch Lucifer. And I've tried to watch the first two episodes. I tried to watch the first episode about 3 times. And then just kind of gave up. And I'm like, I don't know if any of that sunk in. Every time I try to watch it, I'll just be like, oh, wow, I'm reading Reddit. And this show is nearly over. I completely forgot I was even watching this show. Like, I just blank it out. But I tried to watch it 3 times, failed, and then thought, you know what, screw it. I'm sure some of that sunk in. Let's go to episode 2. And then tried to watch that, nothing. And I'm just like, yeah, I can't get into this show. And so that's what scared me off with TNG, you know, is so many people say it takes a long time to hit its stride, as you said. And, yeah, I just worry that that's a long, long way to slog through. I need shows like Bodyguard. Did you see Bodyguard? That one with Richard Madden, Robb Stark from Game of Thrones. Bodyguard, that was good. That show, that TV show, if you watch the first minute of the first episode, you'll be hooked. It hooks you quicker than any show I've ever watched. You know how you got to get through like the first episode before it's like, or first maybe even 2 episodes sometimes before you're like hooked and you really want to watch the next one, or like you really want to keep watching. Literally like the first couple of minutes of Bodyguard, you'll be hooked. It's really well done. Why am I talking about that? Oh, God, I'm tired. I'm sorry about the rambling. Okay. To answer my question, General, sorry, I've got nothing. I Am Norwegian said, it was the classic courtroom scene of the prosecutor constructing the sequence of events leading up to the crime. It's also a nice way to offer the reader a recap of the important bits of the story that happened hundreds of pages ago. Yeah, there was a bit during yesterday's reading, I don't know how many people actually listened to the reading part of the podcast, where I was just kind of paused and went, like, are you just retelling the story? Are you just retelling us what we just, like, slow motion crawled through for the last 700 pages? It's just infuriating. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, "When I read legal thrillers, I tend to blip through these types of chapters. I get nothing. I got nothing either." Oh, wow. Actually, thanks for saying that. I always feel bad when I don't participate in the conversation. I've got really nothing to add. And at the end of that chapter, I just felt so blank. I was just like, a shrug was about all I could come up with. Couldn't even think of a question to ask in regards to it. But, you know, I did feel bad for feeling that way. So I'm kind of glad there's some solidarity, I suppose, in that feeling. Somastar said, same. Oh, cool. Huh, thank you. I admit I finished the rest of the book today and yesterday because I knew the courtroom drama was going to be a slog for me. I skimmed much of the prosecutor and defense arguments. I mean, we already know what actually happened, and I knew what the end result was going to be. Ah, so you skimmed ahead. Naughty, naughty. No, I mean, you can do whatever you want, but I do actually envy that. I'm not going to skim ahead. I'm going to, you know, stick to the program, but I wish I kind of could at the moment. I wish I could just skim read to the end. How's that, though? How's getting to the end of the book, you know, the final moments, and wanting to skim ahead? I just don't know what to say about this book. Laura Weistich said, I'm struggling to understand the point of these chapters, this one in particular, oh, thank you, as it was just a summary of what happened using the assumption that Dimitri did commit the murder. Yeah, it was like a summary of what didn't happen. but again, another person. Yeah, thank you again for being on board the shoulder shrug train. All aboard the shrug train. We're all just on here going, okay. Which is just the worst. Like, if I left my readers at the end of one of my books going, okay, that's the worst feeling for me as an author, to think that people finish my book and just go, okay. Even worse is the thought that they could get to the last 10% of my book, the ending, the big final moments where everything's got to wrap up and all the closure happens. That's when you get closure and learn the moral of the story or whatever's going to happen. It's the most important. Well, you could argue it's the most important part of the book, right? The ending. The thought of people getting into the last 10% of one of my books and then starting to skim read, that's like nightmare material. Somastar says, I think it's one more chance for Dostoevsky to get his rants in. Yep, I think you're probably right there too. His non-committal rants. It's like he wants to rant, but he doesn't want to like make a point. He just wants to make all the different points. Which is, you know, that's something. That's, you know, whatever you're doing, exploring ideas, but it's pretty tedious. Uncle Jossamayor said, hey, I've got an idea. What is your favourite prosecutor? My favourite prosecutor? Or your favourite defence lawyer in the movies? Oh, okay. Remember Kevin Costner in JFK? I haven't seen JFK. Gene Hackman in Runaway Jury? I haven't seen that either. Or in The Firm? I haven't seen that either. Man. Okay, that's three misses for me. I'm trying to even think of who's my favorite lawyer, actor playing a lawyer. You know, I don't know. That's a really hard question. I'm going to go with Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad. What's your favorite actor? My favorite actor? That's a tough one too. But yeah, I'm going to go with Saul Goodman. To make it more digestible and enjoyable for your reading, in these chapters, like these long monologues, you can make a mental movie of the narration. Visualize the action.
Oh, sorry.
And imagine your favorite actor, in the courtroom, acting this scene as you are reading it. Listen to his voice, imagine his expression, his emphasis and pauses, everything on the fly. This will help you keep your focus, retain more information, and make the scene more intense and entertaining. You can listen to instrumental music to add atmosphere to the scene. Have fun. This is really immersive and exciting. Uncle Josselmeyer. Look, I love that people have such a different experience of any book, really. But for you to say it's so immersive and exciting, and then, you know, on the other side of the fence, you've got me and Soma Stars and Swim Said the Mama Fishy and Laura Y. Stitch, all saying they're struggling. It's quite funny, isn't it? Swim Said the Mama Fishy said, okay, I'll play along. Favorite courtroom movie, Jagged Edge with Glenn Close, Jeff Bridges, Peter Coyote, and Robert Loggia. 1985. You can watch it for free on Crackle. I actually think The Brothers Karamazov would translate very well as a mystery legal drama miniseries, either as a period piece or an updated to the modern era. It really is a timeless story, or even as a basis for an original drama. Excellent casting, says Uncle Josselmeyer. Yes, I think this novel is quite modern in many ways, and it can be updated easily for a miniseries. It expresses a lot of existential dilemmas of today's world and the search for some spiritual guidance. In the middle of all that, we got intrigue, legal and financial conflicts, murder, failed relationships, you name it. Quite exciting and timeless, as you fairly said. Henry Loz 70 said, Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson, Demi Moore, in A Few Good Men. You can't handle the truth. You're damn right I did. Order the Red Code. Perfect, says Uncle Josselmeyer. You know, the thing I think about making this into a miniseries, I think, I mean, I'm sure the writers could figure out how to fix this problem, but the problem I see is that as a mystery, it's not structured very well. You know, we all knew who did it very shortly after it happened. The typical structure of the whodunit murder mystery, you've got the immediate culprit where you're like, oh, it was that guy. And then you've got the other guy where you're like, ooh, wait a minute, it might have been that guy. It might have been that other dude. Right? But it's never that other dude. That's the red herring, right? You think you figured it out. So there's the obvious guy, and then you're like, ah, I'm too smart for that. I know it's not the obvious guy. I've figured it out. It's this other guy. And then they switch it up on you. You know, at the last minute, something unexpected happens, and it's someone else, or something happens. But not in this book. It's just like, yep, it was that guy. That guy that you guessed very slightly after thinking it was the most obvious person. And then you thought, ooh, maybe it's this other guy. Yes, you were correct. And then you've got to sit through the other three quarters of the story just knowing who did it. So as a murder mystery, it's shit. So I don't really know how you'd write around that. I think they'd have to do it, add some more, I don't know, more mystery to it. I don't know how they'd do it. I'm sure they'd figure it out. Techrific said, this chapter contains what we thought the previous chapter was supposed to contain. The prosecutor lays out all the evidence, most of it circumstantial, but nonetheless pretty convincing, and tries to tell a story about Mitcher. The themes are compelling to the audience: love, jealousy, money, pride, neglected childhood, and a man, Mitcher, driven by his emotions, irrational, noble, and ignoble. A paradox of a man of intense rage, in short, a man very much capable of parricide. The prosecutor tries to show premeditation and meticulous planning. That seems to contradict Mitch's erratic nature, but at least I am convinced of Mitch's guilt. Had I not known the true facts, this would have seemed to be an open and shut case. The tragedy of Mitch's personality clashing with the harsh reality of the world has doomed him in advance. However brilliant the defender may be, the game, as they say, is up. Yeah, lock him up. Who cares? Hang him. Hang him. I don't care. Do whatever. Do whatever. He's a dickhead. I mean, I know he didn't kill his dad, but he's still a dickhead, so just, who cares? All the brothers, all the characters in this book, screw them. That's my, that's, oh man, what a terrible host I am. Okay, anyway, let's move on. Hey, chapter 8, A Treatise on Smerdyakov. Okay, so this is about to be, just so you know, 8 pages of the prosecutor defending Smerdyakov. We all know he's guilty. And now we're going to have to listen to 8 pages of him incorrectly claiming that Smerdyakov is innocent. I think that's what's about to happen. I don't know why they had to make it 8 pages. I don't know how. Dosto has a knack for drawing things out way longer than they need to be. To begin with, what was the source of this suspicion? Ippolit Kirillovich began. The first person who cried out that Smerdyakov had committed the murder was the prisoner himself at the moment of his arrest. Yet from that time to this he had not brought forward a single fact to confirm the charge, nor the faintest suggestion of a fact. The charge is confirmed by 3 persons only, the 2 brothers of the prisoner and Madame Svigatlov. The elder of these brothers expressed his suspicions only today, when he was undoubtedly suffering from brain fever. But we know that for the last 2 months he has completely shared our conviction of his brother's guilt and did not attempt to combat this idea. But of that later. The younger brother has admitted that he has not the slightest fact to support his notion of Smerdyakov's guilt, and he has only been led to that conclusion from the prisoner's own words and the expression on his face. Yes, that astounding piece of evidence has been brought forward twice today by him. Madame Svetlov was even more astounding. What the prisoner tells you, you must believe. He is not a man to tell a lie. That is all the evidence against Smerdyakov produced by these 3 persons, who are all deeply concerned in the prisoner's fate. And yet, the theory of Smerdyakov's guilt has been noised about, has been and is still maintained. Is it credible? Is it conceivable? Here, Ippolit Kirillovich thought it necessary to describe the personality of Smerdyakov, who had cut short his life in a fit of insanity. He depicted him as a man of weak intellect, with a smattering of education, who had been thrown off his balance by philosophical ideas about his above his level and certain modern theories of duty, which he learned in practice from the reckless life of his master, who was also perhaps his father, Fyodor Pavlovich, and theoretically from various strange philosophical conversations with his master's elder son, Ivan Fyodorovich, who readily indulged in this diversion, probably feeling dull or wishing to amuse himself at the valet's expense. He spoke to me himself of his spiritual condition during the last few days at his father's house, Ippolit Kirillovich explained. But others too have borne witness to it, the prisoner himself, his brother, and the servant Grigory, that is, all who knew him well. Moreover, Smerdyakov, whose health was shaken by his attacks of epilepsy, had not the courage of a chicken. He fell at my feet and kissed them, the prisoner himself has told us, before he realized how damaging such a statement was to himself. He is an epileptic chicken, he declared about him in his characteristic language, and the prisoner chose him for his confidant. We have his own word for it, and he frightened him into consenting at last to act as a spy for him. In that capacity he deceived his master, revealing to the prisoner the existence of an envelope with the notes in it and signals by means of which he could get into the house. How could he help telling him? Indeed, he would have killed me. I could see that he would have killed me, he said at the inquiry, trembling and shaking even before us, though his tormentor was by that time arrested and could do no harm. He suspected me at every instant. In fear and trembling, I hastened to tell him every secret, to pacify him, that he might see that I had not deceived him and let him off alive. Those are his words. I wrote them down, and I remember them. When he began shouting at me, I would fall on my knees. There's just no poetry. There's no rhythm. There's no taste in this prose, is there? It's just clunky and ugly and droll. I could not write such shit sentences if I was attempting to write shit sentences. And he just does it over and over. Every sentence in this book is just uninspired. I don't get it. I don't get this book. I really don't. He was naturally very honest and enjoyed the complete confidence of his master ever since he had restored him some money he had lost. So it may be supposed that the poor fellow suffered pangs of remorse at having deceived his master, whom he loved as his benefactor. Persons severely afflicted with epilepsy are, so the most skillful doctors tell us, always prone to the continual and morbid self-reproach. They worry over their wickedness, they are tormented by pangs of conscience, often entirely without cause, they exaggerate, and often invent all sorts of faults and crimes, and here we have a man of that type who had really been driven to wrongdoing by terror and intimidation. He had, besides, a strong presentiment that something terrible would be the outcome of the situation that was developing before his eyes. When Ivan Fyodorovich was leaving for Moscow, just before the catastrophe, Smerdyakov besought him to remain, though he was too timid to tell him plainly what he feared. He confined himself to hints, but his hints were not understood. It must be observed that he looked on Ivan Fyodorovich as a protector, whose presence in the house was a guarantee that no harm would come to pass. Remember the phrase in Dmitri Karamazov's drunken letter, "I shall kill the old man if only Ivan goes away." So Ivan Fyodorovich's presence seemed to everyone a guarantee of peace and order in the house, but he went away, and within an hour of his young master's departure, Smerdyakov was taken with an epileptic fit, but that's perfectly intelligible. Here I must mention that Smerdyakov, oppressed by terror and despair of a sort, had felt during those last few days that one of the fits from which he had suffered before at moments of strain might be coming upon him again. The day and hour of such an attack cannot, of course, be foreseen, but every epileptic can feel beforehand that he is likely to have one, so the doctor tells us. And so, as soon as Ivan Fyodorovich had driven out of the yard, Smerdyakov, depressed by his lonely and unprotected position, went to the cellar. He went down the stairs, wondering if he would have a fit or not, and what if it were to come upon him at once? And that very apprehension, the very wonder, brought on the spasm in his throat that always precedes such attacks, and he fell unconscious into the cellar. And in this perfectly natural occurrence, people try to detect a suspicion, a hint that he was shamming an attack on purpose. But if it were on purpose, the question arises at once. What was his motive? What was he reckoning on? What was he aiming at? I say nothing about medicine. Science, I am told, may go astray. The doctors were not able to discriminate between the counterfeit and the real. That may be so. But answer me one question. What motive had he for such a counterfeit? Could he, had he been plotting the murder, have desired to attract the attention of the household by having a fit just before? You see, gentlemen of the jury, on the night of the murder there were five persons in Fyodor Pavlovich's. Fyodor himself, but he did not kill himself, that's evident. Then his servant Grigory, but he was almost killed himself. The third person was Grigory's wife, Marfa, and it would be simply shameful to imagine her murdering her master. Two persons are left, the prisoner and Smerdy. But if we are to believe the prisoner's statement that he is not the murderer, then Smerdy must have been for there is no other alternative, no one else can be found. That is what accounts for the artful, astounding accusation against the unhappy idiot who committed suicide yesterday. Had a shadow of suspicion rested on anyone else? Had there been any sixth person? I am persuaded that even the prisoner would have been ashamed to accuse Smurdy, and would have accused that sixth person, but for to charge Smurdy with the murder is perfectly absurd. Gentlemen, let us lay aside psychology, let us lay aside medicine, let us lay aside logic, let us turn only our facts and see what the facts tell us. If Smurdy... If Smurdy killed him, how did he do it? Alone or with the assistance of his prisoner? Let us consider the first alternative, that he did it alone. If he killed him, it must have been with the same object. For some advantage to himself, but not having a shadow of the motive of the prisoner, the murder, hatred, jealousy, and so on, Smurdy could only have murdered him for the sake of the gain, in order to appropriate 3,000 rubles he had seen his master put in the envelope, and yet he tells another person, and a person most closely interested, that is the prisoner, everything about the money and the signals with the envelope lay, what was written on it, what it was tied up with, and above all, told him of the signals by which he could enter the house. Did he do this simply to betray himself, or to invite to the same enterprise one who could be anxious to get the envelope for himself? Yes, I shall be told, but he betrayed it from fear. But how do you explain this? A man who could conceive such an audacious, savage act and carry it out, tells facts which are known to no one else in the world, and which, if he held his tongue, no one would ever have guessed. No one, however cowardly he might be, if he had plotted such a crime, nothing would have induced him to tell anyone about the envelope and the signals, for that was good as betraying himself beforehand. He would have invented something, he would have told some lie if he'd been forced to give information, but he would have been silent about that, for on the other hand, if he had said nothing about the money, but had committed the murder and stolen the money, no one in the world would have charged him with murder for the sake of robbery, since no one but he has seen the money. No one but he knew of the existence in the house. Even if he had been accused of the murder, it would only have been thought that he had committed it from some other motive. But since no one had observed any such motive in him beforehand, and everyone saw, on the contrary, that his master was fond of him and honoured him with his confidence, he would, of course, have been the last to be suspected. People would have suspected first the man who had a motive, a man who had declared a motive, and had Smerdyakov killed the robbed man, Smerdyakov, yet all who believed, though plotting the murder, he told that son Dmitri about the money, the envelope, and the signals. Is that logical? Is that clear? When the day of the murder planned by Smurdy came, he have fallen downstairs in a feigned fit. With what object? In the first place, that Grigory, who had been intending to take his medicine, might put it off and remain on guard, seeing there was no one to look after the house. And in the second place, I suppose that his master, seeing that there was no one to guard him, and in terror of a visit from his son, might redouble his vigilance and precaution. And most of all, I suppose that he, Smurdy, disabled by the fit, might be carried from the kitchen, where he always slept apart from all the rest, and where he could go in bed as he liked, to Grigory's room at the other end of the lodge, where he always put shut off by a screen 3 paces from their own bed. You know what? Do you know what? How this reads? This reads like someone who just is high on drugs and thinks everything they say is interesting. Dostoevsky. Drugs. I wonder. I'm not seeing anything. Psychedelics. Alright, 10 famous authors and their famous drug addictions. First of all, we've got someone addicted to coffee. Lord Byron was addicted to sex. Elizabeth Browning was addicted to opium. Surprise. absinthe, gambling. He was addicted to gambling. I thought it was going to say cocaine or something. He's addicted to himself. That's what he is. This was the immemorial custom established by his master and the kind-hearted Marfignatiev. Whenever he had a fit there lying behind the screen, he would most likely, to keep up the sham, have begun groaning, and so keeping them awake all night, as Grigory and his wife testified. And all this, we are to believe that he might be conveniently get up and murder his master. But I shall be told that he shammed illness on purpose, that he might not be suspected, and that he had told the prisoner of the money and the signals to tempt... How can you talk so slowly? Just say the point. Say your point. Why does everything have to be like this sentence that goes... Just say what you're saying. This is excruciating. I don't know how anyone is enjoying this book. I genuinely don't know how anyone is enjoying this book. Like, what are you saying? How is this taking 8 pages to just say? I'm sure you're just making like one point. And the point that you're making is, it's like a summary of what didn't happen in this book. So there's no point reading it. There's no point to this chapter. Like, there is no point to this chapter. It's just a guy taking 30 minutes to slowly and very particularly and eloquently get it wrong. To murder his master a second time and carry off the money that had already been stolen. Gentlemen, are you laughing? I am ashamed to put forward such suggestions, but incredible as it seems, and knocked down Grigory and Smirnikov got up. I won't press something. But perhaps the fit was a real one. The sick man suddenly recovered, heard a shout and went out. Well, what then? He looked and saw his lying, dying master. What? Quite so. Some astute people will tell me, but... What if they were in agreement? What if they murdered him together and shared the money? And then what? A weighty question, truly, and the facts to confirm it are astounding. One commits the murder and takes all the trouble while the accomplice lies on one side, shamming a fit, apparently to arouse suspicion in everyone, alarm in his master, and alarm in Grigory. It would be interesting to know what motives could have induced the two accomplices to form such an insane plan. But perhaps it was not a case of active complicity in Smurdy's case, but only a passive acquaintance of Smurdy, and he didn't agree to him, was intimidated and agreed to not prevent the murder, but foreseeing that he would be blamed for letting his master be murdered without screaming for help or resisting, he may have obtained permission from Dmitri to get out of the way by shamming a fit. You may murder him as you like, it's nothing, the household, it's nothing to me. But as this attack of Smurdy's was bound to throw the household into confusion, Dmitri could never have been planned. I will waive that point, however, supposing that he did agree, it would still follow that Dmitri is the murderer and the instigator, and Smirnikov is only a passive accomplice, and not even an accomplice, but merely acquiesced against his will through terror. But what do we see? As soon as he is arrested, the prisoner instantly throws all the blame on Smirdy, and not accusing him, of being the murderer. He did it alone, he says. He murdered and robbed him. It was the work of his hands. Strange sort of accomplices who begin to accuse one another of at once. And think of the risk for Karamazov after committing the murder. While his accomplice lay in bed, he throws the blame on the invalid, who might well have resented it, and in self-preservation might well have confessed the truth. For he might well have seen that the court would at once judge how far he was responsible, and so he might well have reckoned that if he were punished, it would be far less severely than the real murderer. But in that case, it would have been certain to make a confession. What's more, Smurdy at the inquiry volunteered the statement that it was he who had told the prisoner of the envelope about the notes and the signal, and for him he would have nothing about if he really wasn't a guilty accomplice. He so readily have made this statement at the inquiry. On the contrary, he would have tried to conceal it, to distort the facts or minimize them, but he was far from distorting or minimizing them. No one but an innocent man who had no fear of being charged with complicity could have acted as he did, and in a fit of melancholy arising from his disease and his catastrophe, he hanged himself yesterday. He left a note written in his peculiar language, "I destroy myself of my own will and inclination." So as to throw no blame on anyone, what could it have cost him to add, "I am the murderer, not Karamazov," but that he did not add, "Did this conscience lead him to suicide, and not avowing his guilt?" And what followed? Notes for 3,000 rubles were brought into the court in an envelope, and now on the table, and that the witness had received them from Smurdy the day before. But I need not recall the painful scene, though I will make one or two comments, selecting such trivial ones as might not be obvious at first sight to everyone, and so may be overlooked. In the first place, Smurdy must have given back the money and hanged himself yesterday from remorse, and only yesterday he confessed his guilt to Ivan, as the latter informs us. If it were not so, why should Ivan have kept silent? And so, if he has confessed, then why, I ask, did he not avow the whole truth in the last letter he left behind? Knowing that the innocent prisoner had to face his terrible ordeal the next day, the money alone is no proof. A week ago, quite by chance, the fact came to the knowledge of myself and two other persons in this court that Fyodor had sent 2 5% coupons of 5,000 each, that is 10,000 in all, to the chief town of the province to be changed. I only mentioned this to point out anyone who may have money, and that it can't be proved that these notes are the same as were Fyodor's envelope. Ivan Karamazov, after receiving yesterday's communication of such importance from the real murderer, did not stir. Why didn't he have reported at once? Why did he put it all off until this morning? I think I have the right to conjecture. His health had been giving way for a week past. He had admitted to a doctor and to his most intimate friends that he was suffering from hallucinations and seeing phantoms of the dead. He was on the eve of the attack of brain fever by which he has been stricken down today. In this condition, he suddenly heard of Smerdyakov's death and at once reflected, "The man is dead. I can throw the blame on him and save my brother. I have money. I will take a roll of notes and say that Smurdy gave them to me before his death. You will say that was dishonorable." It's dishonorable to slander even the dead, and even to save a brother. True, but what if he slandered him unconsciously? What if finally unhinged in sudden news of the valet's death, he imagined it really was so? You saw the recent scene. You have seen the witness's condition. He was standing up and speaking, but where was his mind? Then followed the document, the prisoner's letter written 2 days before the crime and containing a complete program of the murder. Why then are we looking for any other program? The crime was committed precisely according to this program and by no other than the writer of it. Yes, gentlemen of the jury, it went off without a hitch. He did not run respectfully and timidly away from his father's window, though he was firmly convinced that the object of his affections was with him. No, that is absurd and unlikely. He went in and murdered him. Most likely he killed him in anger, burning his with resentment as soon as he looked on his hated arrival. But having killed him, probably with one blow of the brass pestle, and having convinced himself, after careful search, that she was not there. He did not, however, forget to put his hand under the pillow and take out the envelope, and the torn cover of which lies now on the table before us. I mention this fact that you may not note. 1. To my thinking, very characteristic circumstances. Had he been experienced murderer, and had he committed the murder for the sake of gain only, would he have left the torn envelope on the floor as if it was found besides the corpse. It had been Smerdyakov, for instance, murdering his master to rob him, simply carry the envelope and trouble himself to open Vix's corpse to find that it would have known certain the notes were in the envelope. Something envelope, sealed envelope. I ask you, gentlemen, would Smerdyakov have behaved in that way? Would he have left the envelope on the floor? No, this was the action of a frantic murderer, a murderer who was not a thief and had never stolen before that day, who snatched the notes from under the pillow, not like a thief stealing them, but as though seizing his own property from the thief who had stolen it, for that was the idea that which had become almost as insane obsession in Dmitri in regards to that money, and pouncing upon the envelope which had never been seen, he tore it open to make the money, never forgetting to consider that he was left standing in peace of evidence against himself in that torn envelope on the floor. All because it was Karamazov, not Smerdyakov. He didn't think, he didn't reflect, and how should he? He ran away. He heard behind him the servant cry out. The old man caught him, stopped him, and was felled to the ground by the brass pestle. The prisoner, moved by pity, leapt down to look at him. Would you believe it? He tells us that he leapt down out of pity, out of compassion, to see whether he could do anything for him. Was that a moment to show compassion? No, he jumped down simply to make certain whether the other witness of this crime were dead or alive. Any other feeling, any other motive would be unnatural. Note that he took trouble from Grigory, wiped his head with the handkerchief, and convinced himself he was dead. He ran to the house of his mistress, dazed and covered in blood. How was it he never thought that he was covered in blood and would be at once detected? But the prisoner himself assures us that he did not even notice that he was covered in blood. That may be believed. That is very possible. That always happens at such moments with criminals. On one point they will show diabolical cunning with another, while another will escape them altogether. But he was thinking at that moment of one thing only. Where was she? He wanted to find out at once where she was, so he ran to the lodging and learnt an unexpected and astounding piece of news. She had gone off to Mokrory to meet her first lover. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. I'd rather be dead than read that again. I'd rather kick my own face. I'd rather kick myself in the face than ever read this book again. It was the boringest thing I've ever done. Have your say over at Reddit. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.